Okay, folks, we are at the 7:30 mark, so I think we'll go ahead and get started. Welcome all to the, what are we on, July 26th Q&A session for the OPCUG. If you want to join the group, if you're not already a member, there's a link in the chat where you can go to join up, but feel free to continue to join us as a guest at any of our meetings. Later on, I'm going to mute all right now, and as usual, you'll have the ability to unmute yourself. Please feel free to do so if you have a comment or a question. We'll encourage people to stay muted otherwise to keep background noise to a minimum. Later on this evening, the contents of the chat, the audio track, and the PDF of the deck will go up on our website, courtesy of Alan's hard work. And with that, I'll turn it over to Alan to kick it off for tonight, and I know he's going to kick it right back to me.
Yeah, thank you, Chris. Yes, indeed. We have a few different topics tonight, but the first one is going to be Chris basically wrapping up his building a file history replacement. So over to you, as you say, Chris.
Thanks, Alan. Yeah, people will probably be very glad that this is the last of my series on replacing file history with Free File Sync. Next. So our journey so far, and I'm going to paste into the chat all of the URLs relevant to this. So our journey so far, we started off that we wanted to replace, or I wanted to replace file history with another program because basically Microsoft is destroying the Windows file history in Windows 11. And so they're making it more and more difficult. It looks like it's probably going to be deprecated. And so I was looking for a replacement for that because I really liked what file history provided me with. Next. So the next week on July 5th, we looked at how can we use a replacement program, Free File Sync, to mirror a directory that I has my important files in, my documents on the drive C, and mirror those to a directory on an external hard drive. Next. The following week, what we did was we automated the process because one of the joys of file history is that it does its thing in the background. You can have it update new or changed files as frequently as every 10 minutes. So the first week on July 5th, we had a totally manual process to do this. And so on the 12th, we automated the process through Windows Task Scheduler. Next. And then last week, we had the preservation of old versions of files. So one of the other nice things about file history is that it can keep old versions of files so you can go back in time and you can get the version of the file as it existed last week or last month or, at 4 o'clock on, May 2nd, perhaps, and things like that. So we wanted to do that. And Free File Sync does allow us to preserve old versions with actually better flexibility than file history actually provides for us. So we went through that. And next. So this week, what we're going to do is we're going to add more folders because at the start, all we did was you did a documents folder. And most people have important files that are in more than one location. So it might be pictures or videos or a data directory on another drive or whatever. But you may have more than one location that you actually want to have Free File Sync take care of that, backing up the files and preserving old versions of those files. Next. So our backup situation so far. So in part one, we have /backup documents. It'll always have exactly the same files as in my documents directory on the drive C. In part two, we automated it to check every 5 minutes for changes, and you have real flexibility on that, on how often you want it to check for changes and replicate those files. And then in part three, we set up on the external hard drive in /versions/documents, we have old versions of the files that were copied over to the external hard drive. Next. So as I said, most people have more than one location with files that they want to back up, and that's what we're going to accomplish today. So next. So we go back in manually into Free File Sync, and as we have visited on a number of occasions, in the left-hand panel, you'll see the sync job that you actually set up right at the start of this whole journey. Next. And you'll see that over on the right-hand side, it's actually listing the source and destination. C:\users\ctaylor /documents is our source, and where we're backing them up to is E:\backup\documents. And so that's that one pair of folders. But what you can do is you can click on that green plus, and if you hover over it, the tooltip says add a folder pair. So we click on that, and then you get a new row, and you can fill in the source and destination. So in my case, what I did was I decided, okay, I also want to back up my pictures folder, which by default is C:\user\ctaylor\pictures. And I'm going to back that up to E:, my external hard drive, backup, which is where I'm going to have all of the folders are going to fall below that. And then I have a pictures folder below that that I want to back up those files to. Now in that, you can either just type it in, or you can use the browse button and then use File Explorer basically to browse to either of those locations, either the source or the destination. Next. Now an important thing, you have to click the, well, you don't have to, but it's good to click the gear icon that is beside the new folder pair that you actually set up. And the reason why we're going to do that is because this will allow us to set up the synchronization so that you have a separate folder for your old versions of files. Remember on the first one, we were backing it up so that the old versions went to E:\versions\documents. Now we don't want our pictures old versions to go to that. So what we're going to do is we're customizing this additional folder pair. Next. So you click on the Use Local Settings, which allows us to customize any aspect of this particular pair of folders, or this pair of folders. You can customize any part of it. You could actually change it to a different sync type or whatever. But basically we're only going to change one thing in here. So next. We're going to change here the move folders to user defined folder. And it will by default, it was E:\versions\documents. We're actually going to set it to E:\versions\pictures. So old versions of the files will get set into their own separate folder structure. Next. So you have to then save the sync job. Next. And then because we're actually running a batch job, as part of the automation, we have to save the batch job. The reason why you have to save the batch job is all of the parameters are actually saved as part of the batch job as well as the sync job. So because we're running a batch job, we have to update the batch job. So click on Save as Batch Job, next. And then you'll get a dialog box. I would suggest keep the same options that you had before, which I suggest the best options are run minimized so that you don't get every time it runs a window popping up on screen, auto close so that when it finishes, it'll automatically close, and ignore errors so that if by chance your backup drive isn't plugged in at the time, you won't get error messages popping up on the screen. And Mr. Bob Harris, I just muted you. Now that ignore errors again, I talked about it before, that's really your call. If you really expect that the hard drive that you're backing up all your files to is normally going to be plugged in, or even if it's not normally going to be plugged in, you want to get reminded that, hey, you better plug this thing in. You might actually want to have it not ignore errors. Personally, I have it plugged in all the time, and I periodically do check that my backups are working properly. I don't do it every day, but maybe every week or so at least I check to see if it seems to be running correctly. So I have the ignore errors, but your call. But think about that as to what you would like to have happen on there. Next. And then when you click on Save As, it'll come up with the same name for the batch job as you had before. Keep the same file name. And the reason why it's important to keep the same file name is we automated this with Windows Task Scheduler. So we basically told Windows Task Scheduler to run Free File Sync with this particular batch job. So you want it to still run that same batch job, and so you just overwrite the existing file. Next. So our results now. So previously we had /backup documents. We'll have the same files as my documents on Drive C. New, now we have it actually backing up as well. /backup pictures is going to have exactly the same files as in /users/ctaylor pictures. So my pictures folder on Drive C. The automation is going to check that pictures folder at the same 5-minute interval. And next. New, we have now the versions for our pictures is going to go into /versions/pictures paired along with the what we had previously, /versions/documents. So the pictures folder underneath versions will have the old versions of the files that were in the pictures folder. Next. And we're done. So that's it in a nutshell. If you wanted to add more folders, you basically just go that same process of add a folder pair, put in what folder pair you want, make sure you go in, set the local settings for it, save the versions to a different folder so that it keeps the old versions all separate, and you can add as many folder pairs as you want. And basically, I think that following this 4-week process here, you will end up with a result that goes better than the Windows file history. It is more flexible. It has more capabilities in it, but it, as an absolute minimum, will accomplish everything that Windows file history does. So I think it's a worthy contender as a replacement for file history. And anybody who's on Windows 10, there's no rush because Windows 10 file history is still there. If you're on Windows 11, you may want to consider moving now to use FreeFileSync instead because of the damage that they've already done to Windows file history. And certainly once we get to version 12 of Windows or whatever the next version is going to be called, almost certainly, I think, we're not going to have file history available at all. And so if you want that functionality, you're going to have to move to something like FreeFileSync. And I think being a free program that has got a long history behind it, it's definitely a worthy program for doing that function. So if we have any questions before we go on.
There was nothing on this specific topic in the chat, Chris.
Okay.
If people have questions later, we can come back to that.
Okay.
That's a pile of work, and I know it took a pile of thinking about too. It's a really neat system, so I'm hoping people will take you up on it. I can see a definite use for that.
Yeah, if anybody has questions later on, you know how to reach out and get in touch with me. And I'm happy to help you out if you're stumped by anything to do with FreeFileSync using it as a replacement for file history.
Okay. And moving along, we're going to stay with the same theme, though, because I decided I was going to – you talked about a lot of the properties, the features that FreeFileSync offers, but there are some other ones which people might find useful. And in particular, you've basically been talking about the mirror aspect where you get an exact copy of one folder on a backup folder. But there are a couple of other ways to do it, and one of them is called two-way synchronization. And in that, you have a source disk and a target disk, basically your source and your backup, if you like. But what happens in two-way is that you get the newest files on either device transferred forwards and backwards. So you basically get the most up-to-date copy on both devices. So if you create new files or you edit files and update them or you delete files, then those changes will be reflected on both drives. And I actually use this because FreeFileSync is multi-platform, I use it on my Linux box and also on Windows. But I also have a couple of computers, so I've got dual boot systems on a desktop and a laptop, and I'd like to keep everything basically in sync. Just 1 second here. Wait. I use this two-way a lot, and we'll come back to that in a minute. But there's another way to do it, which is called, FreeFileSync calls it update. And basically update is like mirror in that it makes an exact copy, but it doesn't delete anything. So if you think about the backup drive having a couple of old file folders, files one and files two, and then you update some files in files two on your source drive, and you create some new files on your source drive, then this update process will update the files two on the backup, and it will copy the new files over, but it doesn't get rid of anything. So if you didn't have old files one on your source anymore, it would still stay on the target drive. Some synchronization programs call this contribute, because you're contributing new and updated files, but you're not actually deleting anything. So the example I have is exactly that, where we send some updated files across and populate them in the old files 2 directory because they're updated there. And then we have a new folder which we send over to the target drive. Now, I'm not sure where you would use this. I mean, one possibility I think is if your target drive was some kind of archive, and you had all kinds of folders in there, which you were building more and more all the time. So an example, I guess, would be you're keeping an archive of all your digital photographs and the various trips you've taken in different folders on this archive drive. And then you come along with an SD card or you copy it to your hard drive. You've got a new folder on your hard drive. You're going to contribute that. You're going to update it to your archive folder. But you don't want to copy back all the old files back to the source or delete the old files on the target. You want to just add the new material to your compendium, your compilation of file folders. Personally, I wouldn't do that. I'd just create the new, get a folder of the new SD card images and just copy them to my archive disk. So I wouldn't bother with doing that with FreeFileSync. But, you know, maybe there's a use case there. I'm just not quite sure what it is. Anyway, back to my situation. So here's the disk management view of one of my hard drives. And you can see this is a GPT partition system. So it's got multiple partitions. It's got a big one there highlighted, which is the C drive in Windows. And over on the right side, there's another fairly big one, which is the Linux Mint, the operating system and applications and that kind of thing, in a separate partition. So that's the dual boot system. I can boot into Windows on one partition, or I can boot into Linux on the second partition. And right in the middle there, there's a dedicated partition which I use for data files. And on Windows, this shows up as drive D, and I've given it the volume label data disk. And the reason for that is because on Linux, it doesn't use drive letters, it just has a mount point. And the mount point is in the media folder, and I've called it data disk. So in Linux, my data drive shows up as data disk. In Windows, it shows up as drive D, but it also shows up as data disk. So the beauty of this is I've got data files, exactly the same data files. I can access them either by Windows or by Linux. And what I really want to do is make sure I have a current backup of those. So I'm going to use FreeFileSync and two-way synchronization between my data drive and my external USB. So this is what it looks like when I do that. So over here is drive D, which is the data drive. And on this side, the target is drive U, which is an external flash drive. And you can see that there's a whole bunch of different things happening on that drive when I hit compare. It finds a whole bunch of files which are new or changed or it doesn't know or whatever. So if I take a little look in a bit more detail, you can see, for example, that these files that I've outlined in red here are Word files, and these files down here are Free Pascal program code, and they have got a green arrow with a plus sign, which means that they're brand new files on the source drive, and they don't exist on the target. So Free FileSync has decided that it wants to copy these brand new files onto my backup because they don't exist there. So what I'm going to do now is I'm going to cheat a little bit. I'm just going to run Free FileSync just to copy those particular files over to the backup so I can clean the display up a little bit. All right. So now I've still got one file here, which I didn't copy over. It's still got the green arrow and the plus sign, but you can see it's called temporary screenshot. So this is actually an image file, a screenshot, it's actually one of the screenshots I've used in this PowerPoint presentation, but I've used it, so I don't actually want it. So rather than make a backup of it, Free FileSync gives me the capability of changing what Free FileSync wants to do, i.e. it wants to copy it from the source to the target. I can change that basically by hovering over the plus sign here. When I hover over the plus sign, I can move the mouse over to the left and it will show me a delete button. So if I now click on that, or if I select that now, it will actually change the copy to from source to target into delete this file on the source. So I have the power to make changes on the fly. I don't have to do what Free FileSync wants me to do. Some of the other files, you can see here I've got one called zfreefilesync.pptx. So this is actually a file which has the slides I'm showing you right now when they were in development. And when they were in development, I had PowerPoint open, and so it had created a backup, which is this tilde version right here. Because these files are works in progress, again, I don't really want to back them up to my backup drive. So I can prevent that by, again, hovering over the green plus sign here. I don't want to do that. What I want to do is just deselect these two files. So rather than have this checkbox check, I'm going to click on that and basically unselect it. And I'll click on this one and unselect it. And when I do that, those two files will disappear from the list of action items, if you like. So I can take those two files out of the process. So now I've got another file here, which is called zeroindex.txt. So this is a text file which has all the topics for the current Q&A or for the Q&A sessions, including the one for tonight. And there's a brand new version of it, which I've updated recently. But that file already exists on the source drive as well. So what it's telling me now, the green arrow to the right with no plus sign, just means that this file exists on both drives, but this one, Free FileSync has decided is newer, and therefore it decides that it wants to copy it to the source, and then it will overwrite this old version of the file here. And then the same thing will happen down here with this maintain.odt file, which is a LibreOffice writer file, which is a maintenance log, essentially. Again, it belongs on both drives, but I've updated it, so it's going to get copied over. Now, there's one other file in there, which has this lightning flash. And basically, if you hover on that, it says both sides have changed since the last synchronization. And free file sync doesn't really know what to do with it because both files have been updated. So what's probably happened here is I'm working right now in Windows because I'm using PowerPoint. So I've probably updated this file in Windows, but I also updated it previously, the same file on my data drive. I've updated it previously in Linux. So as far as free file sync is concerned, the Windows version of it, it sees the two files, it realizes they've both been changed, but it's not quite sure which one it should do. So I now have to make the decision what to do about that. So actually I need some more information. So if you look on the top here, you can see that what I've actually got is I've got the size of the file and the date of the file, the time date stamp for both sets of files. So looking on this left side here, you can see that the file linuxprogress.txt is 1.69 megabytes, created at 11:46 in the morning on the 23rd, whereas this one on the right-hand side is only 1.68 megabytes, and it was created on the 18th, so several days ago, as opposed to the 22nd. So clearly this has been updated again. It's got more information. It's a later date than the target. So I can now make the decision that, yes, I want this file to be copied over. So again, what I would do in that case is hover over the lightning flash, drag the mouse to the right, which would highlight the right green arrow. I'd select that, and now it would know that I want to copy that file over. So those are the kind of things you can do to overwrite the default actions that free file sync decides that it wants to do. Now, there's some other things that you can set. I showed you that we'd set the size and the date here. We also noticed that I've got it set for relative path. It says relative path. So relative path means these are the files and folders relative to my target drive, so drive D. So in other words, this file right here, this JPEG file, is in the root directory of drive D, whereas my presentation file here, which is a PDF version, is underneath the root in Allen OPCUG presentations. And my maintenance log is underneath the root in the folder called transfer. So I'm looking at these files and folders as being relative to this root here. If you don't like that version, then you can change it. So for example, if I right click on this title bar right here, I'll get a context menu. And you can see that I've got relative path set, but I've already set to show the size of the file and the date stamp, the time date stamp of the file. But now what I can do is if I don't want relative path, I can choose to take full path. And the other thing you can do is you can actually show icons on the taskbar here, and you can have small, medium, or large, for example. So let's go ahead and change relative path to full path. So now here's drive D, but now because I'm showing the full path, you can see that Ecuador is in the root, D colon backslash, and this PDF file is in D colon Allen OPCG presentations. So it's giving the full path to this file. So that's a kind of a preferential thing, which version of that you prefer. And you can show icons. So here I've set those parameters to show small icons. So when I have a JPEG, I'm seeing a little JPEG icon. PDF file is showing me a viewer type icon. And the ODT file shows me a LibreOffice writer type icon. If you switch that icons to be medium, then it makes the individual listings much bigger because it has to show this thumbnail. And clearly, if you show large, then you don't get to see very many file listings. So personally, I turn icons off. I don't really find that very useful. Okay, one other thing that you can do. This red funnel thing here is a filter. So it allows you, and you've told it what the source drive is and what the target drive is, but you can actually control what folders are to be included or excluded on this target drive. And sometimes that can be useful. And by default, FreeFileSync will choose some folders to be excluded, things like the recycle bins and those kind of things. It doesn't copy those over. But you can see I've included a couple. So I'm including everything except for the things that star means include everything, except for the things which I tell it to exclude. So you can tell it here I've told it to exclude this hidden folder, which is called Trash 1000. And that's because that's my Linux recycle bin on the data drive. And again, like the recycle bin in Windows, I don't want the Linux recycle bin to be backed up. And also, on one of my systems here, I think on the Linux system, no, on the Windows system, I told it not to back up Thunderbird star. So in other words, on my data drive, don't back up the Thunderbird folder, which is my main message folder, and don't back up Thunderbird local folders, which is my local folders folder. And that's just to keep things clean so that I only back those things up from my Linux drive and things don't get confused. So clearly by playing around with include and exclude, you have complete control over what FreeFileSync is going to do. And with that, I think that is really about all. And we really are done. And so Chris has given you a wonderful system to back things up manually. And I've kind of tried to show you how you can take complete control if you want to do things completely manually. And clearly the idea is the best of both worlds is probably the way to go. Okay. Again, I don't see anything in the chat. So Everybody's completely fed up with FreeFileSync. let's move along. And Stuart is going to unmute his microphone and tell us all about Google Lens and something else.
There, microphone. Ah, wow. I need a cigarette after that talk. That was draining. Okay, folks, who likes Google Lens? I should say, who doesn't like Google Lens? It's a really useful little tool. Best thing you can do with it, delete it. Get rid of it. Make some space. Because if Alan would show me the next slide, as I think he's got, you don't need it. It's built right into the Google search app. So essentially, if you have the Google app on your phone and the Google Lens on your phone, you've got Lens twice. Just look at the Google search app, and beside the little microphone, there is a little lens icon. And if you tap on that instead of the microphone, you've got the full lens experience, the Cadillac experience of Lens. And you've saved a few megabytes if you've deleted the original app. So, you know, the great assimilator, Google, has taken a really useful tool and integrated it into one of its other useful tools, and I don't remember them telling us about it. Microsoft does that too. These are two assimilators that like to grab other programs and suck them into their ecosphere and leave you wondering why things have disappeared here and why they show up there. Anyway, Google Lens is no longer really necessary as a separate app on your device. Google did this with the Gas Buddy app too a while back. If you look in Google Maps, there's a list of little things you can quick search on that scrolls across the top of the Maps app. And one of them is gas. If you tap on that, you'll get almost the full Gas Buddy experience. And if you're not actively contributing to the Gas Buddy app, you're just using it to look up stuff, I would say get rid of Gas Buddy and just use the Google Maps gas search function to look for prices, and you'll save a lot of megabytes, not only in space on your phone, but in bandwidth that the Gas Buddy app is sucking down as it's broadcasting your location and speed of driving and which grandmother you ran over when you turned the wrong way at that red light. So, anyway, I've digressed enough.
Okay, thanks, Stuart. But don't go away because your series of loony bits is going to continue. These are Canadian sites that are of interest to people because you have one that's fairly local, I think.
It is. The Duchy de Bicoline. I don't know if I'm pronouncing it even remotely correctly. But just in the hills northwest of here, there is a small village that's been built over the last 20 years or so that's known internationally, actually. I'm sure everyone's heard of these people who like to dress up in medieval costume and role play to their heart's content. Well, Bicoline is an internationally renowned place to do that. And it's just about 20 kilometers from where I'm sitting now. And they've built themselves quite a little village there. It's visible from the highway, so you don't even have to go in if you want to just like peek over the fence with a pair of binoculars of what's going on. But it literally attracts thousands of people in the summertime. It's a tremendous tourist attraction. There's people in authentic costume and not quite so authentic unless you're heavily into Game of Thrones or Lord of the Rings, because there's even elves wandering around and ogres and the odd, we don't really know what you are. but there's many activities, and they have battles and jousting, and no, I don't think they subject any equines to that sort of activity, but they go and beat the heck out of each other, so there are battles. And if you are really shy, you don't want to go anywhere near them, just come to Shawinigan and look around. There'll be an elf wandering around in the grocery store stocking up on something healthy for the after battle celebrations. Bicoline.org, English for you folks.
Okay, thanks, Stuart. Carol has a question about Google Lens. She doesn't know what it does.
Carol doesn't know what Google Lens does.
I'm just looking at my phone, and so it seems like I can look at any object and find it for sale. What else does it do? I never heard of it.
Oh, gee, it's too bad Karen isn't here. She loves it. Point it at a plant and ask it what it is, or take a picture, or if you're in a store, point it at it at something, and there should be
It started out, it just looked like a camera, but then I saw that, anyway, okay.
It's sort of like Google search visually.
Okay. Yeah, cool.
I think it basically turns your camera on and then tells you what it's looking at based on a Google search.
Yeah. Okay. Great. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, Stuart. So Bob Walker is up next. Bob has some updates for us on a couple of things he's talked about previously. So I think Bob is probably going to show his own deck.
Yeah, I'm just starting to share the screen now. And here we go. There we go. Okay. Yep. So have updates here to a couple of presentations I did about a year ago. The first one is Video Download Helper. We looked at this. It's a browser extension, and it has a companion app that works with it. They have several more flavors now, but back then, they had flavors for Firefox and Google Chrome browsers. And we looked at it back in May 4th, 2022. It allows users to very easily download videos or just the audio portions of videos from sites like YouTube. We focused on the Firefox version because at the time, Google, who owns YouTube, blocked Video Download Helper and other download apps from downloading specifically YouTube videos when using Google Chrome. They didn't mind you downloading other people's videos from the other company's sites through Chrome, though. Now, Google wants you to live your Google life online and in the cloud, and that way they can track and monetize whatever you do. And once you download something, they lose that ability and any control they had over it and the ability to monetize whatever you're doing. So the best features of Video Download Helper are it's very quick and very easy to use. Literally, you're looking at a video on YouTube. You click on the icon in the upper right corner of the screen. It gives you a brief menu. You click on your choice, and boom, you're downloading the video. You don't have to do anything else. If you want to just download the audio portions, it's three or four clicks. But it's very easy to do, and once you've started the download, you can go to another video and start a download on it. So you can download several videos concurrently. Nice thing about it is it downloads the entire video cleanly, the video and nothing but the video, or the audio and nothing but the audio. You don't get the extraneous material at the beginning and the end of the video that you get using video screen capture tools. And if you're recording a long video especially, it filters out any of those really incredibly very annoying ads you often get in the middle of many of the YouTube videos. A few months ago, Video Download Helper stopped working for a great many users. It was not entirely clear at the time whether this was due to a Windows update, to some other problem, or the most likely culprit to Google now blocking Video Download Helper and some other download tools, even when using other browsers like Firefox. Now, since then, Video Download Helper has come up with their latest release, 8.000. This only partially fixes the problem. They've come out with a beta release, 8.001, but apparently reportedly it doesn't fix the entire problem either. And at the same time, the ability of VLC Media Player to download YouTube videos also stopped working for many users. So this is sort of an across-the-board thing. As much as some video download helper YouTube downloads will now work. Part of the problem seems to be related to the subscribe button that you see below the video when you're in YouTube. And you can see it there, an example. If you see that button, the Video Download Helper download is less likely to work. Doesn't mean it won't work, but it's less likely to work. If you do subscribe to that particular channel, sometimes that might allow you to download the work. For example, I got blocked on downloading a I clicked on subscribe, and it was it was a Playing for Change video. So I clicked subscribe, and I'm already a member of Playing for Change. So I was able to download that video. But on others, I've tried to subscribe, and it didn't change the problem. If there is no subscribe button on the video, video download helper is more likely to work. So the bottom line is that for the time being, at least, the ability of video download helper to download YouTube videos is not consistent. And I hope this will be fixed at some point in the future. I'm crossing my fingers on that. In the meantime, what do you do if you want to download blocked YouTube videos until VDH is completely fixed? First solution is you can use a video screen capture app like Debut Video Capture or Screen Hunter Pro All-in-One Screen Capture. We've reviewed both of these about a year ago, and so you can get some idea of what they are from that. The issue with using a video screen capture tool is that usually you get a bit of extraneous material at the beginning or the end of the video, or the very beginning or very end gets cut off. So if you get too much, you might want to edit it out. And they also don't filter out commercials in the middle of the video. The second solution is you can use a video download tool that still works with YouTube, like WonderFox Software's HD Video Converter Factory Pro or Easus Mobi Mover. Now, these apps are multifunctional. They're not strictly a download tool. They convert formats, download and edit videos and audios, transfer files to and from phones, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But they're usually somewhat complicated to use. No one or two clicks to get things going. You literally have to copy the URL of the video you want and go through a process. The other thing about these apps, and it's not just these two in particular, but there are several in this group, they're usually free to download, but a fully featured non-limited version will cost some money. And the fully featured versions are often subscription-based, so you have to pay either a monthly or an annual fee to keep using it, unless you pony up even more money for the so-called lifetime version. And at some point in the future, I may do a review of one of these. The next thing we're going to look at an update is iTunes. We looked at iTunes back in August 2022. And at the time, Apple was pushing you to download the Windows version from the Microsoft Store. So if you went to the Apple site, and clicked on download iTunes, it would transfer you over to the Microsoft Store. Now, the Windows version of iTunes from the Microsoft Store updates automatically in the background. If you have an older version of iTunes from the Apple Store downloaded the Apple version from the Apple site at the time, iTunes still had nag screens when it was time for you to manually start the update process. It wouldn't update automatically. Now, since then, Apple has gone back to primarily offering the download of the Windows version of iTunes from Apple. You can still get the Microsoft Store version with the automatic updates, but you have to go directly to the Microsoft Store and download it from there. Now, I couldn't verify if the Windows version that comes direct from Apple now updates automatically or whether it's still a manual update with nag screens. But if you manually update an older version of iTunes to the current version, it doesn't, the updated version isn't an automatically updating version. So you still have to delete your old iTunes, go to the Microsoft Store site, and get the new version from there. Now, all that said, iTunes used to be a pioneering site there. They were one of the first to offer media for sale, and they're really great. But it's getting a bit long in the tooth now. Apple hasn't really maintained it and kept it really current. So if you've used iTunes for quite a while and you have a large music, movie, and other media library in the iTunes cloud, you might want to stay with iTunes. But that said, there are better paid media download sites out there. And I haven't explored this extensively because I have a large iTunes library I've been building for several years. So, and I got about all the stuff I need. So I'm not in a big hurry to switch over. And the other thing is that most music, movies, other media is available for free on the internet if you look hard enough. Now, that's some of this is illegal and infringes on copyrights, and some of it is in that sort of gray area in between if you download it for personal use type of thing. The big advantage of using a paid source as opposed to getting it for free is you get consistent high quality. If you download the audio part, for example, of a lot of YouTube videos to get the song, the quality ranges from quite good to really, really terrible. The sound level of the resulting MP3, some of them you have to turn up the volume to hear it because they're all there. They're very, very soft. And then you get to the next song and with the volume turned up and it blows you out of your chair. So the big advantage of the paid sites is you're getting consistent high quality and consistent sound levels. And that's it for tonight.
Okay, thanks, Bob. There were a few comments in the chat. Chris notes that uBlock Origin, which is a free add-in, seems to block all ads in YouTube automatically. Jocelyn says Enhancer for YouTube can block ads and do more. And Jeff has put in a link to a site called tinywow.com. So I guess that's also something to do with downloading from YouTube or whatever. Okay, so we're in that kind of last 10 minutes deal. So if anybody has any questions, and there was one much earlier from B. She says, do you have any comments about Google Enhanced Safe Browsing? My answer is no, because I've never heard of Google's Enhanced Safe Browsing. Anybody out there know anything about it?
I've heard the term, but I have not looked into it at all. It's relatively new, but I'm not sure what it is they're trying to accomplish. I guess the only things I did read was that some people were really suspicious that it wasn't really going to be as effective as Google was leading everybody to believe, primarily because if it was effective, it would actually impact their ad revenue.
Well, when I it came up and I did allow it, and I know, but I think I noticed that my Google mail takes longer to load.
Oh, jeez.
But I that could just be like my imagination. I was thinking of turning it off and seeing if it.
Yeah, it should be an option that you can toggle on or off, I would presume, right?
I believe so. I have the instructions. Okay. I did download the instructions. I have them as a Word file. I can send it to you. So you can manage it. You can manage them.
Yeah. Well,
it sounded like a good idea at the time, but I probably should have researched it more.
Well, as long as you can toggle it off again, I don't think it's really a big deal to try it out. They usually give you some kind of indication of what it is that they say they are going to do for you or against you. I haven't looked at it beyond the couple of articles where people were not overly impressed with the idea. I don't think anybody was saying that it was necessarily a bad thing. It's just that it wasn't going to do any great things.
Going to do anything amazing, yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay.
Okay, thanks, Bea. There was another question from Edith. She says she has Hotmail. She's receiving more than a dozen scam mails every day. Previously, she was able to block them, but now they're coming with no email address. And how can I get rid of them? Well, you can get rid of them just by deleting them, but what else can I do, and can I report these scams? Anybody know anything about Hotmail?
Well, it's actually Microsoft now. It's Outlook.com is essentially what you're on. And I have heard some complaints from the likes of people like Mary Jo Foley of All About Microsoft and I think Paul Thurrott as well, saying that they were noting a big uptick in the number of spam and scam emails they were getting through Outlook.com. So I haven't really done anything with this, but if that is true, and certainly Mary Jo Foley and Paul Thurrott are pretty trustworthy, it sounds like Microsoft has broken something in their what used to be pretty good filtering for spams and scams. What you could do about it, unless you can key on something, and usually blocking doesn't really do any good, unless it's done heuristically. Blocking an email address doesn't really do any good because they change the scammers and spammers will change the address it comes from anyways. So usually that doesn't really help at all. So my thoughts on it is just delete them as they come in. I don't know. Does anybody have a better option than that? I hear resounding silence.
Unless you get some kind of commonality in the emails that you can filter.
Yeah.
But my guess is that there are no common features to these things.
Yeah.
I mean, the only other thing you can do is change your email address, but I mean, that's just a real pain.
Yeah. And there's no guarantee that it's not going to quite quickly get picked up by the spammers again anyway, so.
Yeah, true.
Yeah.
Okay, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I'm on Simpatico as well as Google and Gmail. And I noticed on Simpatico, I get at least two emails a day from claiming to be Bell about my Bell account, and one at least a day about McAfee, and on and on and on. Yeah. And they all come from different places: Germany, France, Japan. I have no idea. I tried logging them to Bell, but it didn't seem to do anything.
And Zimpatico is now run by Microsoft, so it is essentially Outlook.com as well.
Okay, that makes sense. It's been behaving very badly lately.
Yeah, Linda's had a lot of problems with Zimpatico over the years, let alone recently.
I probably get at least 5 or 6 a day, B, as well.
Yeah.
The good news, though, is if you don't have a Bell account, they're really easy to spot.
Yeah.
Well, if you're on Zimpatico, you are a Bell customer.
Well, it is a Bell account, but they are still quite easy to spot. I mean, yeah. I mean, basically anything that says it's coming from Bell is a scam.
I've been getting quite a few phone calls from Bell, which I haven't been picking up. Are they scams? Well,
I get 2 a day some weeks.
Yeah.
Are they scams? Pick
them up. But no, they're usually just,
telemarketers.
Because I'm a subscriber, they're usually just trying to get me to buy more TV channels or something like that.
Okay.
It's never to say they're lowering my price.
Well, I highly recommend what I do is my outgoing message is due to the number of scam calls that are out there, I don't answer my phone. And if you're not a scammer and I believe you, I'll call you back. And I never answer the phone unless it's a phone number I recognize on the call display. And the scammers always hang up before the 4th ring, which is where I have it go to the voicemail. And so they never leave a message. So,
I probably get 3 or 4 long distance calls a day, and they're either valid or they're not, but I don't pick them up and nobody leaves the message. Yeah. So they're either trying to sell me something or it's a scam, because it's never important enough to leave a message.
Yeah, often they will hang up before your answering service will actually pick it up. Like mine, I have it set to the 4th ring, and they always hang up before the 4th ring. I don't know why, but they do. It's extremely rare that I'll end up getting something. And usually when I do get something, it's not really a scammer. It'll be a survey company or something like that, which I also don't want to talk with, but it won't be a scammer. But those are the only sort of companies that will end up hanging around long enough for their automated message to say, we have a survey for you. Please press 1.
Hey, Chris?
Yeah.
Maybe the reason they hang up before the 4th, maybe so that they don't really pay any charges.
Well, I don't think they pay any charges anyways. They're all doing it over IP.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, there might be some reason. Cost, maybe.
Yeah. I just don't understand why. I would think that a lot of people would take them 4 rings to get to the phone. I don't know.
You can get more spam calls than if you don't let it ring very, very long.
Yeah.
You know, even some of these calls that you think are from Bell, the software is readily available to scammers to spoof the number and the caller ID.
Yeah.
And Bell and the other big carriers have the ability to block this. But these scammers are big customers of theirs. They don't want to piss them off. So unless the government makes them block all the spoof numbers, then we're stuck with it.
I'm wondering too if the 4th ring is related to the fact if it is automated, as soon as your answering machine answers, you've answered, and so they can't call you back because that's a done. The machine won't necessarily know if you said yes or no because it didn't connect to an operator, but it's almost like, yeah, we've already called Chris Taylor and we didn't get a yes from him because it talked to your answering machine. Maybe
my answering machine doesn't kick in because
that's what I'm saying. If they wait till your answering machine kicks in, it's like they contacted you and then they wouldn't contact you again. Whereas this way, they just keep calling you again and again. Sometimes I'm just so that they won't call me back.
Yeah, I have done that on occasion. I'll have my clock radio beside me here, and I'll turn it up full volume, and then I'll answer it and just put the receiver over top of the clock radio. Usually after about 30 seconds, I'll go and I'll hear beep, 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 and I'll hang up.
Okay, Jocelyn says that Bing has a nice map that has a lot of live cameras. And when you click on one of the cameras, you see the live video from that location. He wants to know if Google Map has the equivalent. Anybody know that?
They have traffic cams. But I don't know of anything other than traffic cams that they have available.
Are the traffic cams on their map?
Yeah, it's been a long time since I looked, but I'm pretty sure. Let me just look.
When I was doing a Google search, I found the City of Ottawa live camera, but I could not see it anywhere on Google Map.
Yeah, I don't see it now on the web version of it. I was sure that at some point I did see it somewhere on there. I find that Google Maps is really weird. I find it hard to find some of the options on it. It's really strange. I don't know. I can't find it now, but.
Maybe somebody would like to do a share on Google Maps or Bing Maps or something.
Yeah.
Somebody that knows what they're doing.
Yeah, that's right. That's not me.
Okay, we're over 5 or 6 minutes over the witching hour, so let me just wrap up by saying that next Wednesday, August the 2nd, will be our next Q&A session. Right now, there is absolutely nothing in the pipeline, I don't think. So if you have questions, or if you can tell us all about hot cameras on Bing or Google Maps, or you have other topics that you want to share with the group, like some of the ones we've had tonight, just drop us a line to suggestion box at opcud.ca, and as usual, we'll be happy to retain a spot in next week's deck for you. So other than that, we'll see you next week on August the 2nd. Bye for now.
And don't forget that next week will be our 150th Q&A over the Zoom. So be there as part of our celebration.